I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee, Executive Editor at Information Security Media Group. Today I'm speaking with Keith Fricke, who is the partner and principal consultant at TW Security. We're going to be discussing cybersecurity challenges facing rural healthcare providers and other challenges. So, Keith, you work with many different kinds of healthcare sector entities, but what are some of the special cybersecurity challenges that you see rural hospitals and smaller healthcare providers struggling with the most these days?
The smaller organizations typically have less budget to work with. They may also have fewer staff, and in some cases, many people wear multiple hats. And we've seen the security and privacy officer also be a nurse, or a caregiver, or even an executive. So there are some challenges in these organizations being able to put together and manage a well put together security and privacy program. Another challenge that they face is that based on their location, they may not be able to attract talent. They may have the budget, but maybe even offering positions for people to work remotely. Those remote workers may pursue opportunities with larger organizations because they're in larger cities, or maybe there's a higher salary for those types of jobs. I think that one of the other challenges we see is that a lot of these organizations are small enough that they outsource their IT department, and sometimes that person might be a person that does work for them part-time, because they're also working at a local school. And so they've got limited cyber skill knowledge and skill sets, especially when it comes to the healthcare industry and the requirements that HIPAA have. So I think that that's sort of the set of the more obvious challenges. Some of the less obvious ones are if an organization in a rural setting has some sort of a cyber incident, especially if we talk about ransomware, and it shuts down parts of their operation, they don't have a community of resources that can come in quickly and have boots on the ground to help them re-image their laptops and workstations, or just sort of manage the incident. So there's a little bit of isolation there in terms of the resources. Another area that's not often thought about is that the population in these rural areas are small. So everyone knows everybody. And that can sometimes lead to snooping in patient records. And oftentimes it's not with malicious intent, but it may be more of a concern. A person knows that a family or a friend or a neighbor is being seen at a rural clinic or hospital, and they just want to know if everything's okay. But that's still a HIPAA violation, despite the fact that they have good intentions. So I think that those are some of the more common challenges that we see in a rural healthcare setting.
So now, Keith, I understand that your organization has been working with a large healthcare system to help provide cybersecurity training to rural and smaller healthcare entities. Can you tell us a little bit about that program? What sort of cyber training are you providing, and what sorts of individuals are getting the training?
Yeah, that's something that we're very excited about. This large academic medical center has a benefactor who had provided some funding for TW Security to provide some training to interns on how to do risk analysis. One of the common weaknesses that we see in smaller healthcare organizations is the lack of a comprehensive risk analysis. And oftentimes it ties back to budget, as we just discussed. The idea here is doing more of a train the trainer, where the interns will go out and do the risk analysis work for these small rural hospitals, identify the weaknesses that they have, and put together an action plan, as is required by the HIPAA security rule, so that there's some way to help get these small rural hospitals and clinics at a point where they at least have gotten the risk analysis and an action plan completed. We tend to see in the resolution agreements that the Office for Civil Rights posts that one of the common findings or citations is the lack of a thorough risk analysis. So this is one way that we can kind of help participate in getting parts of rural America a little more up to speed on where they need to be with the HIPAA compliance rules.
So, Keith, when you work with these small and rural healthcare facilities, what are some of the key cyber skill sets that you see that are missing that might be contributing to some of the security incidents that we see and in the breaches?
I think there are a few. The common gap in skill sets comes back to the point about how some of these rural hospitals and clinics are outsourcing their IT and the limited availability of those IT resources, you know, might lead them to have people that know some things about desktops, how to set up Windows, maybe how to install antivirus, but they're not really familiar with the breadth and depth of what the HIPAA security rule requires, or even what would be considered industry best practices for protecting an organization. You know, they're not maybe up to speed on some of the options that are available, either through the federal government or some low or freely available tools that can do things such as conduct internal phishing campaigns to help raise awareness about how the workforce can spot, you know, phishing attacks, understanding from an availability perspective what some of the options are from a technology point of view about how to back up data and how to keep it isolated so that unauthorized access or ransomware don't impact the data backups so that they can do restores. So I think there's a more holistic view of information security and privacy that's necessary that many of these rural hospitals and their IT folks don't have as part of the acumen that they need in order to best protect the electronic information that they have.
Keith, you mentioned some of the free resources that are available. What other advice do you have to these smaller rural healthcare providers in terms of, you know, stretching their cyber budget, you know, stretching their resources so they can tap into, you know, as much of these, you know, this knowledge that they might need, but they might necessarily have the purse strings to get? Any suggestions?
There are organizations out there, much like ours, that offer some sort of a virtual support where, you know, we can be a fractional information security officer or privacy officer. And that takes the burden of those duties and responsibilities off of people that are wearing multiple hats. And it sort of entrusts the third party that's coming in with some of the insight, vision, and program management that they don't have time for or the knowledge to successfully implement. So relying on, you know, other resources outside of their general geographic area is a good place to start. They may also want to look into what sort of grants are available at the state or federal level that they could apply for to get some financial assistance in helping them shore up some of the deficiencies in their security and privacy programs, not only from a technology perspective, but even just, you know, policies and procedures that are a necessary part of the whole compliance world. And lastly, I think, you know, where possible, establishing a network of peers. They may be in a small isolated area, but there are many other small rural hospitals that exist in the same county, the same state. They may want to reach out to some of their peers and try to share information and resources so that they're not operating alone, because they really aren't alone. They just need to establish those networking opportunities so that they can share information. And we tend to see that in the medium to large size organizations, especially when you start to see something in the news that's happening from a cybersecurity perspective. an organization may reach out to some of their peers in their networks and ask, are you seeing what we're hearing in the news? Or we're seeing this type of activity. Have you seen it? And if so, what did you do about it? So there's opportunities for information sharing that, make that resource freely available. It's just a matter of knowing who and where to reach out to.
Keith, you sort of mentioned this earlier too. When a rural hospital is attacked and its IT systems are brought offline, patients are often left with few options on where they can go that is nearby for emergency and other vital care. With this in mind, any top suggestions for how rural hospitals and rural communities overall can bolster their incident response, their resiliency, and business continuity plans to better deal with these kinds of IT outages?
I think it really starts with making sure that the organization has some sort of awareness program in place that helps the workforce recognize a phishing email that tends to be still the number one vector of attack. And so doing that sort of takes them down the road of preventative measures. In the unlikely and unfortunate event where there is some sort of a cyber attack that takes them offline, they may have to make decisions about diverting patients to other locations. And in some cases, that may be many, many miles away. Having backups is critical in being able to restore the information. It depends on the nature of and the scope of an incident that forces downtime. There are many options in still delivering patient care without some of the systems that are relied upon, like an electronic health record, things like that. But it's when the event forces a shutdown of the network or connectivity to the internet that can cause a lot of operational issues. And that's really kind of leading them down the road of, it's a really good idea to do some tabletop exercises. We do those very frequently, and it's an eye-opener for management if you walk them through a two-hour exercise where ransomware has shut down or causes a shutdown of a significant portion of their environment. How do they respond to that? What sorts of decisions do they need to make? If they have cyber insurance, do they understand what its limitations are and what the expectations of its carrier or broker are? These are all really good things to explore prior to needing to use them for real. And it puts them in a better position to respond rather than trying to figure it out as they go along if it happens for real.
So now, Keith, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recently released proposed rulemaking to update the more than 20-year-old HIPAA security rule. What's your take? When you look over some of these proposals, what stands out to you? What do you like? What don't you like?
I think it's long overdue, as most of my peers would likely agree to. I think that there are a couple areas that resonated with me that I liked. I think they're trying to do a good job of adding some specificity. The rule that we live by today came out just about 20 years ago in its final form, and they left it intentionally ambiguous to make it a little easier for people to interpret how they needed to implement some of the specifications. Over time, we've seen an awful lot of technology emerge and shape the way that we do things. And the proposed security rule is trying to keep in step with some of those things, such as, really requiring the development of an asset inventory and a network map. And that network map is intended to help an organization understand what the flow of electronic protected health information looks like in the organization. And that's something that the payment card industry data security standard has required for a long time. And I think that it's good for an organization to understand how EPHI flows through its environment. Not only so that it can better ensure that it's protecting that information, but a Network diagram like that becomes very invaluable if you're working through a cybersecurity incident. I also noticed that there's going to be a lot more granularity when it comes to conducting a risk analysis. It's getting very specific about citing that your risk analysis needs to include all of the reasonably anticipated threats, identifying the potential vulnerabilities, and putting some sort of a risk score to that. I think one of the reasons that we're seeing that language explicitly defined in the proposed rule is that, and we've seen this at TW Security, some organizations conduct what they think is a risk analysis when in fact what it is, it's a gap assessment against compliance. And what they've done is they've taken the Office for Civil Rights HIPAA audit protocol, and they consider that to be a risk analysis. When in fact, what that audit protocol is doing is guiding an organization through looking at policies, procedures, and practices and making sure that they have all the right documentation. There's nothing about that that's really risk analysis oriented because it's not identifying reasonably anticipated threats, your controls and vulnerabilities, and a risk score. So I think that the proposed rule is trying to call that out very specifically so that people understand the difference between a compliance gap assessment and a risk analysis. There are some requirements about notification when there's a breach. This causes me a little bit of heartburn only because having been in the role of an incident response commander, it's easy on paper to require somebody to provide notification within 24 hours. But sometimes the investigation takes a long time in order to identify what happened and what the scope is. I suppose that it's well intended that you at least are obligated to notify other impacted parties within 24 hours that there's something going on. But sometimes that can cause undue alarm if you don't really know how big the scope is or what's really impacted right now. You know, if you recall some of the large breaches that we've seen in 2024, it took a long time for those organizations to release information about what happened because the size of the organization and the scope of the problem required an awful lot of investigation in order for them to get their arms around just what's going on. So I think that that's going to be a little bit of a challenge. I also think there's a proposed requirement for network segmentation. There is certainly value in segmenting networks, but I think the challenge for small organizations is going to be trying to meet that requirement because that requires an investment in technology and the skill set necessary to manage that network segmentation. And without getting overly technical, most networks are flat these days, meaning that they're not segmented. And to try to move certain types of computer systems and business and clinical applications and biomedical devices to other network segments is a lot of work. And it takes a lot of time and money potentially to implement that. And that only scales as the size of the organization grows. The network segmentation isn't a popular implementation, even in medium-sized organizations. So I think it's well intended and long overdue. I think, you know, if I had to speculate, there's a lot of uncertainty right now based on the change in administration in the Oval Office as to how this is going to continue through its, you know, proposed review period. And if it follows suit with other of the regulations that we've seen, there's usually an interim final that's released and then a final. And I don't know if the government will expect organizations to comply with it in 2 years after the final is released, like the current security rule is, or the government may choose to scale back the due date for compliance because most everything that's in the proposed rule, Marianne, is building upon what already exists in the current security rule. And the Office for Civil Rights is expecting that healthcare organizations are already complying with it. So they may feel that there's not as much time required to implement these. I'm kind of hoping that they give 2 years just because not everybody can move as quickly as some of the larger organizations can in trying to comply with whatever's coming down the road.
And finally, Keith, anything else that you're keeping a close eye on in terms of cybersecurity in the healthcare sector this year? Anything brief that kind of comes to mind?
There's two, going back to the rural discussion for a moment, I wanted to mention that the International Association of Forensic Nursing put together a Telesafe toolkit. And this is a Telesafe, TelesaFe. The safe portion of that stands for Sexual Assault Forensic Exam. And this toolkit was funded by a grant issued by the Department of Justice to the International Association of Forensic Nursing back in 2021. And over a 3 year period, the IAFN put together this Telesafe toolkit. And what it does is it provides organizations and clinicians with guidance and tools to help them conduct medical forensic exams using telehealth. And so we've seen telehealth, really gain a lot of adoption, especially during the pandemic. But I think we still need to keep an eye, to answer your question, we need to keep an eye on how we're using teleconferencing solutions in order to conduct patient care, because they all don't have all of the security and privacy controls that they should. And so when we were asked to partner with the International Association of Forensic Nursing, we helped them put together portions of the toolkit that focused on the security and privacy, things like evaluating teleconferencing technologies, whether it's something that you're looking to acquire or something that you already own, but does it line up with what you should be doing from a security and privacy perspective? And then securing digital photography is another area that's addressed. So I think that, what we'd like to keep an eye on is how is existing technology being used and how is it evolving to ensure that we're still maintaining the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of systems that we need to. The other big thing that's on everyone's mind right now is artificial intelligence. It's been around for longer than people think. It really took a foothold in corporate America in November of 2022 with the release of ChatGPT, and a proliferation of all of these other AI platforms are coming out. The things that it can do are amazing, and I think that it can go a long way in providing improved patient care. The challenges that I see are that many organizations haven't put together any sort of a governance structure about making decisions about who should be using AI, how they should be using it. And if you think about it, Marianne, we sort of went through a similar situation when social media started creeping into the business world. There were policies that needed to be created and access and education to the workforce. The difference, though, is that social media is really a one-way vehicle for data. We're posting things out there for other people to see. Artificial intelligence is responding to prompts that we're giving it, and it's giving us information back that we need to trust but verify. We don't know a whole lot about what goes on behind the scenes with artificial intelligence computing. How is it getting its large language models? How is it being educated? Is it being hosted by the same vendor you think it is, or is it being handed off to others? We start to see a lot of vendors offering products and solutions that they say are AI enabled, but we really need to question what that means. And are they handing off their AI computing platform to another third party? And what's happening to the data that we're sending out there? So I think there are a lot of opportunities for AI to do good, but we also have to keep an eye on making sure that people are using it appropriately. And lastly, as you might expect, the criminals are starting to take advantage of AI. We're starting to see phishing emails that are very well crafted because the AI platform can sort of remove any of the grammar and spelling errors that someone who used to compose phishing emails had English as a second language. That's kind of going away. We're starting to see more sophisticated attacks. AI is being used to generate malicious software. And so it's just another opportunities for criminals to expand their enterprises as they adopt this technology as well. So I think those are probably the couple of biggest things: artificial intelligence, the use and evolution of existing technology, and waiting to see what happens with the proposed security rule.
Well, thank you so much, Keith. I've been speaking to Keith Fricke of TW Security. I'm Marianne Kolbasek-McGee of Information Security Media Group. Thanks for joining us.